Could you start by giving a general description of the Navy during the Napoleonic Wars?
In the long wars of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Empire, the Royal Navy was the dominant naval force on the world ocean. In 1793, when the French Revolution War breaks out, the Royal Navy is somewhat outnumbered by the powerful fleets that the French and the Spanish possess. Fortunately for the British, the Spanish fleet is still an ally for 3 years, and the French fleet goes through a catastrophic revolutionary process which effectively removes all of the skilled officer cadre, leading the Navy to be led by very junior officers, merchant sailors, and enthusiastic politicians who simply lack the professional skills to run these large complex ships and to organize and conduct major fleet battles. The morale of the French Navy plummets. Revolutionary councils are not good for discipline on board ship. By contrast, the Royal Navy goes to sea relatively well prepared, with a 100-year history of winning major wars, winning major battles. And the only major fleet battle in the early period of the Revolutionary War, the glorious 1st of June 1794, sees the English main fleet defeat the French main fleet and capture 7 of its ships and drive it home in confusion. This establishes a pattern that will persist for the next 20 years. Whenever there is a major fleet battle, the British win. The Royal Navy is more effective in combat, its ships are better drilled, better manned, it has more professional officers, more professional crew, its logistics are superior. Every detail of the Royal Navy is thoroughly up to date. English cannon, for example, are far stronger and more durable than those of the French, which have a nasty habit of exploding. This means French sailors aren't keen to load and fire their guns because they may kill them. English sailors are very confident their guns will not explode. This means the English fire faster and more effectively. These battles are fought at very close quarters. Naval combat is not at a distance. You can see the enemy, you can see very clearly what the enemy is doing, and you can hear them. It's about achieving firepower dominance. You fire faster than them, you hit them harder than they hit you, and eventually they stop fighting. Not because you've persuaded them of anything, but because you've killed so many of them they can't fight on. It's a really grim, rather attritional business. You kill a lot of them and then they stop, and the ship is then yours. And many of the ships in the Royal Navy of this period were captured enemy warships. Having captured them, the state bought them, refitted them, and sent them back to sea. This meant the British didn't have to build all the warships they needed. They simply had to build as many as they couldn't capture from the French, the Spanish, the Dutch, the Danes, and the Americans. This is a highly successful warfare organization. It's unparalleled. There is nothing else in this period that is anywhere near as successful. People often talk about Napoleon's great armies and the success they had, but they all got beaten. Napoleon ended up defeated and exiled. The Royal Navy was unbeaten throughout this period. And that tells us a great deal about how successful the British state was in organizing the financial, the industrial, and the logistics backup to keep this enormously costly force going. Britain in 1793 is a highly sophisticated fiscal warfare state. It has very powerful tax raising and loan raising facilities. It's able to use its national debt and its banking system to absorb ever higher levels of warfare debt and to service those debts at relatively low levels of income. This enables it to operate a navy. Navies are far more expensive than armies. In this period, an army is a lot of peasants who are not otherwise doing anything. A navy is a huge amount of infrastructure, hardware, floating resources. The ships that are fighting in these battles are the largest and most complicated things that men build that can move, and their costs are necessarily high. They're also vitally important status symbols. The Royal Navy is not only successful, but it's also emblematic. It's no accident that at the centre of London we have Trafalgar Square, and we have a Roman column celebrating Nelson's victory. We also preserve Nelson's flagship, which is the Ark of Englishness. It is the emblematic English item. It's an English-made ship that fought in many battles under many great admirals, and not just Nelson. And its name goes back to the Armada. There was a victory in the Armada battle as well. So this name, this battle, this man, this is the iconic moment in the establishment of a British national identity. The Navy has some issues. It is perennially short of skilled manpower. And everybody will be familiar with the story that many of the men were impressed, forcibly taken into the Navy by a press gang, a gang of men sent out by the Navy to take them into the service. There are many myths about the press gang. Firstly, that the Navy took anybody. It didn't. It only wanted skilled seafarers. And it could identify these men very easily from their clothes, their physique, and simply by looking at their hands. A skilled sailor would have tar ingrained into the lines on the face of his hands from working aloft with ropes. He would also walk differently to a landsman. His clothes would be cut differently. They were called short clothes. They're the clothes that men wear today, short jackets, trousers. These men were at a premium because there weren't that many of them, and without them the ship doesn't go anywhere. On Nelson's Victory, you need 200 men to operate the sails, and all of those men need to be skilled. You need another 600 men to pull on the ropes, but those men need no skills and are easily recruited. So impressing men who are professional seafarers is a right that the English Crown has retained since the Middle Ages. It's controversial not because it's illegal, but because it's often applied with less discrimination to merchant ships belonging to other nations. The Americans often claimed that the British impressed a lot of their sailors. This is true. Almost all of those sailors were Englishmen. And if they weren't, they were English-born, and the English did not recognise a transfer of nationality. So anybody who was born in Britain remained British under British law and could not transfer their allegiance to the United States. The United States, as a country of immigrants, necessarily recognised a transfer of allegiance, so there was a clash of jurisdiction here. Impressment was essential because without it, Napoleon would have won the war, and the consequences of that for the history of the world would have been quite striking. Napoleon is a latter-day universal monarchy man who believes in creating a single homogeneous empire under the rule of one dictatorial empire. The emblems of his empire are Roman, eagles, imperialism, and the very way in which he organises his states. This is the new Roman Empire, and what the British are fighting for is not to be in Napoleon's European empire. And they're using the resources of the rest of the world to wage this war. So commanding the ocean gives them command of world trade, gives them command of the world economy, and they're able to use the world economy to fund their war effort and to fund the allies in Europe who fight against Napoleon with large armies. What Britain does not do is raise mass armies to fight Napoleon. We're often told about the success of the British army, but these are very small armies of voluntarily raised men. They are not conscript armies. So while the Europeans conscripted soldiers, the British effectively conscripted sailors because it was far more important to Britain to win the war at sea than it was the war on land. Being an island has real advantages. It allows you to have a naval defence which at the same time can control the trade of the enemy and profit your own trade. So throughout both of the phases of the war, the Royal Navy blockades France, destroys the French maritime economy, captures French overseas colonies and possessions, stops France trading with the rest of the world outside Europe, and essentially bankrupts France over the long period. It's even more striking in the case of Russia. In 1812, as we all know, Napoleon invades Russia. He invades Russia because the Russians have broken out of his continental system, an economic system which attempted to keep the British out of European markets. Russia simply could not survive economically without trading with Britain. And Tsar Alexander decided it was better to fight Napoleon than to be bankrupted and to follow his father Paul to an early grave. Tsar Paul had broken with the British in 1800, and as a result, his noblemen murdered him and replaced him with his son because they couldn't afford, quite literally, not to trade with Britain. So Britain's command of the world economy leverages the way different states function. The Russians don't necessarily like the British, but they can't live without them. The French, they can live without. And they end up fighting Napoleon in 1812 for that reason. So sea power is all-embracing. It covers the whole of the world. The Royal Navy is fighting everywhere. And it has an almost unbroken run of success. So it is by far the most successful military organization of the revolutionary Napoleonic era. And it ends the war on a tremendous high. What the British insist at the end of the war, when they make peace not just with the rest of Europe, but also with the United States, is that the two most contentious aspects of Britain's strategy, the right to impress seafarers and their very hard interpretation of maritime belligerent rights, their ability to stop neutral shipping and to impose blockades, is simply not discussed at the Congress of Vienna or at the Treaty of Ghent with the Americans. These are the most controversial issues. The French, the Russians and the Americans would all like to stop Britain doing this. But the British simply won't allow them to even bring them to the conference table. these issues are left, and for the next century, Britain is in a position to use the same set of maritime belligerent rights that it ended the Napoleonic Wars with. And this is the foundation of the subsequent British Empire, which is an empire of global communications and sea control, not an empire of territory.